Well, good afternoon. You know, in the Adventist Church, we talk a lot about the remnant, and you always know that there's the remnant of the remnant, and those are the people who show up for afternoon meetings. So thanks so much for being here. I heard a story once. It was a speechwriter, a presidential speechwriter, and he was talking about the presidents who make very good speech makers and those who are not so good. And he made a comparison. He said, Jimmy Carter was never happy to give the same speech twice. He'd give a speech, and then he'd move on, and he'd want to make a different speech the next time. Said, in contrast, Ronald Reagan would give the same speech in city after city, day after day. He'd be just as happy, just as enthusiastic, the same words, and by the end of the time he was giving this, he would have it down just perfect. Whereas poor Jimmy Carter was always giving a new speech, and it was never quite got the right pitch and the right pace. You know what I'm saying? Well, I'm afraid I'm a little bit more like Jimmy Carter in the speech giving than Ronald Reagan. I like to give new presentations. But there's a risk to that, and that is it can be a little rough. And this is the first time, friends, the first time that I'm giving this presentation. So if it is a little rough, all I can tell you is there's a price to pay for being the first to hear it. And if it goes well, maybe I'll give it a 5 or 6 more times. We'll see. As you heard, I'm an Adventist lawyer. Some people think that can't happen. A Christian lawyer, that's an oxymoron. A lot of Adventists don't like lawyers, I've found. In fact, when I was when I was in law school, I had a woman come up to me in the lobby of my church, and she had her daughter with her. And when she came up, she said to me, my daughter wants to be a lawyer. And you know, when you're going through law school, you get a lot of people asking you questions. And normally they come up and they say, you know, you're in law school, how do you get into a good law school? Or how do you excel in law school? Or what can you do with a law degree? Those sorts of things. So I was getting ready to give that response. But instead of asking me that question, she said, when my daughter asked if she can be a lawyer or go to law school, I replied, lawyers, Christians can't be lawyers because Christians can't lie. Then she turned around and walked away from me and left me blushing in the lobby of the church. You know, they say you shouldn't get too proud as a Christian. Well, that sister was doing her best to keep me, you know, keep me grounded. What I found is Adventists don't really like lawyers very much, but they do love free legal advice. In fact, every church I go to, and I predict it's going to happen today too, I get questions about wills and estates. I get questions about torts. I get questions about family law. I get questions about everything you can imagine for free. Well, it's good being a lawyer, and it's good being an Adventist, and most of all, it's great being a Christian. Today, I'm talking about a new topic. It's not going to be the gospel, although it is related to the gospel. The gospel was the sermon I was giving before. If you want to find out what that was all about, you would have had to go to the churches I spoke at earlier in this year. Today, I'm talking about the true meaning of love. The true meaning of love. My father passed away last month. Maybe some of you knew him. He was killed suddenly in an auto accident. And it's taken a lot of time, and still will, of course, to deal with that loss. It's very, very painful. But one of the things my father used to talk about was the difference between truth and present truth. The difference between truth and present truth. You see, there are many truths I could talk to you about this afternoon, things that are true, maybe even eternally true, but they're not truths that are on the cusp of the issues that you are going to deal with in your life. There is a difference. It's a difference between, for example, sitting around and talking about the need to replace a roof of your home in 15 years when your house is on fire. Friends, when your house is on fire, you got to talk about getting the fire engine there and doing something about it and let the roof take care of the roof in 15 years. Are you with me? Yet as a church, over and over again, we tell his sermons about what happened thousands of years ago or what's going to happen in the future. But how often do we come to church and hear about now? Friends, I don't live in the future. And you don't live in the future. And we don't live in the past. We can't stay in the past. We have to deal with now, because the only time we ever have to do anything is right here and right now. When we do talk about current events, We have a tunnel vision. How many of you would get excited if today I got up and I wanted to talk with you about Sunday laws? Yeah. I know there are many. Oh, Catholics. People would be really excited about that. But right now, we have a crisis in our society, and I'm going to tell you, it's also in our church. And the crisis is not about Sunday laws. The crisis is about the other institution that God gave us in the Garden of Eden. God gave us two institutions in Eden. He gave us the Sabbath, and what else did He give us? Marriage, friends. And if there's an attack on marriage, shouldn't we be just as concerned as we would be if there's an attack on Sabbath? Shouldn't we? And yet today in our society, we're living in a time of unprecedented attack on the institution of marriage, and we are largely silent. And we cannot be. We cannot be because God has given us knowledge, God has given us insight, and God has given us a gift to go out and give to our world. And if we are silent in this time of crisis, we are not neutral. Because silence in the face of evil is not neutrality, it is complicity. Do you want to be complicit in evil? I do not. And even though it's unpopular, and even though it's difficult, friends, I am here today to talk about true love. We have a choice in our world today. We either change our world or our world is going to change us. Do you believe that, friends? I believe that entirely. We're either out there trying to change our world or our world is in here changing us. And make no mistake about it, the world has done a fabulous job of changing the Seventh-day Adventist Church, changing individual lives, and changing individual families, and not changing them to the image of God. When I was born, it was 1965. 1965 was a grand time to come into this world. It was a time of enormous change. It was a time of a revolution. It was just at the beginning of the sexual revolution. You've heard of the sexual revolution, haven't you? You should. Most of you lived through it. And at that time, we were told something completely new in the history of humanity. We were told repeatedly through our movies, through our music, through our cultural leaders, that sex outside of marriage was no longer wrong. In fact, that it could be healthy. It could be appropriate. It could be fun. It could be good. It could be wholesome. Go out and experience life to its fullest. This was in stark contrast to the Bible. For example, Christ, speaking in Matthew 15:19-20, said for this, "For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, blasphemies. These are the things that defile a man." Now, just in case there are some who are not familiar with the term fornication, that means sex outside of marriage, plain and simple. Christ identifies this as one of the things that defiles us. So on one side you have the world saying things have changed. We now have birth control. We can do this safely. We can do this enjoyably. We need to experience life to its full. One partner in your whole life is not enough. Go out and change the norms of society through the sexual revolution. And on the other you have Christ saying, if you do this, it defiles you. Who was right? Who is right? Well, let's look at the results, friends, because the social experiment has been done, and the results are in, and there is no ambiguity in those results. First, let's look at the impact on the sexual revolution on children. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control reports that the percentage of American children born to single women increased from 5% in 1960 to 10.7% in 1970. That would be a doubling. But by 2003, the percentage was 34.6. So between 1960 and 2003, there was a 692% increase in the number of children born in this country to single mothers. Should we care? Some people say one style of family is just as good as another style of family. We've got to accept all styles of family and just move on. Look, friends, I admire single mothers who bring their children out, but I know it's not easy. My wife and I have two children, and I can tell you, as a double parent family, it ain't easy. I can't even imagine what it's like as a single parent. But we have to be honest and talk openly, friends. When I went through high school, And I went through an Adventist academy, I went through Adventist elementary school. I don't think anyone was speaking about this. I remember seminars about backward masking on rock and roll tapes. I remember that stuff. I remember stuff about the Illuminati and all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories. I don't remember anyone talking much about sexual purity. If we're not talking about it, it doesn't mean nobody's talking about it. I remember getting it in the music, the TV, the movies. They were all talking about it, and they were giving the opposite message. Well, let's see if we should care about the huge rise in the number of Americans born outside of marriage. I should say that when divorce and out-of-wedlock births are combined, roughly half of American children spend some time of their upbringing today in a single-parent family before reaching adulthood. That statistic comes from a book by Frank Fustenberg called History and Current Status of Divorce in the United States. Almost half of American children, friends. Should we care? Is this good? Is it bad? Is it neutral? Well, let's look at some factors that go along with single parenthood. First, poverty. The poverty rate for children in single-parent families is 400% higher. 400% higher than for those in married households. Secondly, the impact on children's academic performance is dramatic. There have been a number of studies on this that found that children living in single-parent families have lower math and science scores and other academic achievement scores than children growing up in a married family. I remember when we were thinking about having children. One night, Lisa and I walked by a home, and there was a mother sitting in her bayfront window. We live on Capitol Hill, you know, in a row house. Everyone's sort of along there, and we just were walking along the sidewalk. We looked in, and that mother was sitting there reading a book to her child. And I said to Lisa, I said, how is that child going to compete with that child academically? There's only one way, friends. As if we do that for our kids, right? If you don't have parents pulling together to get your kids the academic grounding, how do you think it's going to happen? And if you have half the number of parents at home, you have half the number of resources to do it. It just makes common sense. And yet over and over again we've been told, no, all families are equal, the results are equal. The results are in, friends. The studies are in. The results are very, very different. And if we care about our kids, if we care about our society, someone has to stand up and say something, and if it's not you, who is it going to be? If it's not our church, who is it going to be? Crime. Stephen Levitt, who's an economist at the University of Chicago, said this: childhood poverty in single-parent households are among the strongest predictors that a child will have a criminal future. You want to have a kid with a criminal future? Take their dad out of the picture. Child abuse. The Department of Health and Human Services did a longitudinal study on child abuse. Between 1980 and 1993, also a time period where the divorce rate and the number of kids growing up in single-parent households skyrocketed, they found that during that period, the rate of emotional child abuse was up 48%. The rate of physical child abuse was up 84%, and the rate of sexual child abuse rose a staggering 458%. Should you care? The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services also compared children living with both parents and children in single-parent families, and they found this: the children in single-parent families have a 120%, or a little bit more than two times, greater risk of being endangered by some type of child abuse or neglect. Over twice the rate of abuse or neglect among single family kids growing up outside of a married family. And something that's very hard to measure is the pain that goes along with kids who miss their father or their mother. Their mom and dad are split. Some of them don't even know who their mother and father is. We were told in the 60s, we were at the beginning of a whole new experiment in society. Don't listen to what God said. That's historic. It's back in the old days. We have a new world coming. We have a new pill. It's going to change the world. You can have everything that you want here and now with as many partners, and there's no consequences. In fact, it's going to be healthy. The results are in, friends. It has not been healthy. It has not been healthy on children. But it also has not been healthy on the people who have been practicing multiple sexual partners. We know the abortion rate, for example. We were told that that abortion should be safe, legal, and that it should be rare. Today in America, there are roughly 1.1 million abortions performed on healthy babies with healthy moms conceived through consensual sexual relations. Now, some people might think that's rare, friends, but I think over 1 million abortions a year is not a rare occurrence. And there is enormous pain that goes along with that, and enormous suffering. And if that was not pain enough, let's look at what's happening with our sexually transmitted diseases in this country. Roughly 50% of Americans, according to the American Journal of Medicine, roughly 50% of Americans will contract a sexually transmitted disease in their lifetime. Now, I hope we're not an average group here, friends. I assume we're not. But if we were an average group of Americans, and if you didn't have a sexually transmitted disease, you'd have a pretty good chance that the guy sitting next to you does, or has had, or will have. Are you with me? I just saw a report in New York, 25% of adults, that's 1 in 4 adults, has genital herpes. Now, I didn't hear about that watching Friends, or when in Seinfeld, when they were jumping in and out of bed, nobody ever talked about contracting a painful sexually transmitted disease that never leaves you. But that is the reality that comes with defying the law of God when it comes to human sexuality. Today we spend about, as a nation, $13 billion to treat sexually transmitted diseases per year. That's approximately $100 from every taxpayer in America. 65 million Americans today are living with a viral sexually transmitted disease. That's according to the American Social Health Association. So on one side, we had God telling us that fornication is wrong, that it's damaging, that we shouldn't engage in it. And on the other side, we had the world telling us that fornication, sex outside of marriage, is good, that multiple partners are a positive thing. Who is right? The evidence is in. Sex outside of marriage brings great harm to children. It brings poverty, crime, academic problems, behavioral problems, and child abuse. It brings abortion, and it brings a devastating plague of sexually transmitted diseases. The world told us a lie, friends, and we need to get out there and tell people the truth. And I want to appeal. I know that there are some young people here. You have a choice to make. And it's a difficult choice because you're going to have a lot of pressure to conform with the world. But I pray that you will choose to conform to God, because it's going to make all the difference in your life. Your physical life, your life right here on earth, but not just that, your spiritual life. And your life preparing you for a life ahead. We were not only told that sex outside of marriage was good, positive, beneficial during the time of the sexual revolution, we were also told that marriage was an institution that should not be for a lifetime, but rather should be for the period of time that people were interested in each other, until you started to get uninterested in each other, and then you should go your own way, because at the end of the day, the highest calling in life is self-fulfillment, self-gratification. Divorce if you want to, stay married if you want to, do what you want to according to what you feel at the moment. What impact has that had? Well, on one side you have the world telling us that marriage is valid as long as people want to stay together, as long as you have two mutually interested parties, and if there's not, they should go their own ways. On the other side, you have Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ said this. He said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced also commits adultery. You know, we're used to the soft saying of Jesus these days, don't we? You know, you hear all these sort of things, you know, all the soft. Jesus has a lot of very hard things to say. This is a hard saying. It goes directly against what we've been told in society. Now, when we rewrote the divorce laws in this country, our church had nothing to say. What would we have to say about loosening divorce laws so people can go their own way whenever they want to? You know, marriage is the only contract you can break with impunity. Try breaking a sales contract. Try breaking a contract on your building, a building project. There's penalties. But marriage, it's 50-50 and you walk your own way. There's no penalty for walking out of a marriage contract. We were told this is going to make things more rational, more sort of logical. Well, and our church had little to say about it because we said, well, that's out there. That's out in the world, right? We'll still do our things our way. And whatever they do out there is not going to impact us. But friends, I got news for you. We are society and society is us. You want to know what America looks like? Look around you. You want to know what society looks like? Look around you. When divorce rates skyrocketed in the world, you know what? They skyrocketed in the church too. After the divorce laws were rewritten, the incidence of divorce more than doubled from the mid-60s up to the late 70s. Lawrence Stone, who's from Princeton University, had this to say. He said, the scale of marital breakdown in the West since 1960 has no historical precedent that I know of and seems unique. There has been nothing like it for the last 2,000 years and probably longer. How does it feel to be living through a unique time when people's marriages are breaking down like they never have before in history? You feel good about that? Well, some people might say, well, going your own way, that's a good thing because, you know, who wants to be trapped in a marriage that's not working? Well, that's fair enough. Well, let's look at some studies on that. The Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health released a study. This is in the year 2000, and this is what they found. They found that divorced and separated women and men are more than twice as likely as married persons to kill themselves, to commit suicide. Have we created a happier country? A better society? But more importantly, on average, there's been a lot of study on this now because we have a lot of people to study, a lot of marriages to study. And I will say, just so you know, I don't want to be up here holier than thou. My parents were divorced. Probably nearly every one of you has a divorced relative if you're not divorced yourself. This is not something that's, like I said, when we thought it was out there, when I was a kid, I remember the first child in my school whose parents got divorced. It was just like shocking. Now, walk into an Adventist church or an Adventist school and look around. Ask people. Well, you may be better not. But what you're going to find out is that what was out there is now in here. This is what they found some studies that they've done on the question of whether divorce makes people happy. On average, people who are unhappy in their marriage are equally unhappy once divorced. Similarly, this is a study done by a group of academics. They found that except in extreme situations, the majority of troubled marriages can and do improve with patience and work. The quick solution of walking away from a marriage is nearly always the worst solution. They also found that 2/3 of divorcees are uncertain whether they did the right thing or explicitly regret their decision afterwards. You know, when I worked in California, I did an MBA before I went to law school, and I went out and I managed one of the medical groups in at Loma Linda. And I had an employee there. She was a really lovely person, and her husband ran off on her and married her best friend. Right? And years later, they met up at a party. And her husband, her ex-husband, came up to her and he said this. If I would have known how hard it was going to be the second time, I would have stuck with my first marriage. Well, it's a bit late. It's a bit late, friends. But I hope if there's anyone here today who's thinking about leaving their husband or leaving their wife, about breaking up a family, about getting out of the marriage relationship, think twice, friends. There's no panacea in this life. Half of the problems in any marriage are likely to be you, right? I know at least half of the problems in mine are me. And thank goodness I don't have a particularly troubled marriage, but you know, we're all human, aren't we? Friends, when this whole thing of rewriting our marriage laws came up, we thought that was out there. It wasn't our business. We don't have anything to worry about it. And yet this has caused tremendous harm, not only to the people who have gone through the divorce process, but of course the children of the families that go through this. I can tell you, I was an adult when my parents divorced. I was about 29. And there is nothing that has been more painful to me in my entire life than the day that my parents went their separate ways. Nothing. And if you think that just because your kids are out of college, it's not going to matter, go your own way, you are dead wrong. Dead wrong. God set up an institution for us. God set up a way. God set up a plan for us. And the minute that we accept what the world is telling us, we lose. We lose as individuals, our families lose, and our society is poorer because our society is only made up of the people that are in it and the families that are strong. Friends, first we were told to redefine sexual behavior. Sex outside of marriage is fine. Second, we were told, hey, let's have divorce, whatever people want to divorce, no consequences, no teeth to the marriage contract. Now we're asked today to go one step further and totally, fundamentally redefine what marriage is. Should we go there? Well, let's think about it. On one side, we're told that there is absolutely no difference between a homosexual relationship and marriage. And you cannot tell the difference, and the society should not in any way make a differential determination. On the other side, you've got what God tells us in Romans 1:24-28, where we're told, therefore God gave them over to their sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity from the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and they worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Does that sound like our society today, friends? Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way that men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another, men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty of their perversion. This is hard sayings, friends. They're hard sayings, but they're true sayings. This is also what we're told in 1 Corinthians. Do you not know the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor adulterers, nor idolaters, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites. That's 1 Corinthians 6:9. Today we're told that the Bible is very ambiguous on homosexual relations. I remember hearing one guy, he was actually a minister, get up and say at the National Press Club, there's only one text in the New Testament that even deals with this, and it's very ambiguous. Well, I just read you two, and I'm not even a minister. Why shouldn't we support redefining marriage? Well, first, we go to the children. The American Psychological Association's Review of General Psychology recently published an article that concludes that there is overwhelming evidence that the love of mothers and fathers differ in significant ways and that receipt of both kinds of love is very beneficial to children. Does that surprise you? You know what, friends? I'm not a member of the American Psychological Association and I haven't done any studies. But I really didn't need that study to know that. You know why? Because I had a mother and a father. And their love did differ. And it was very important that I had both sides. My father taught me how to be a man. My mother gave me love and softness that I couldn't get from my dad. Love and caring and style. She also had an appreciation for many things that my dad did not. Maybe some of you had a mom and a dad too. I hope every one of you did. And I hope that they gave you love that was very different, but both very important. Similarly, a recent study found that teenagers living with their two biological parents have significantly improved mental health and academic achievement, and significantly lower rates of serious behavioral problems at school compared to teenagers living in single-parent households or, quote, blended households. This study was sponsored by the Urban Institute, which has published material in favor of same-sex marriages, but frankly concludes that, quote, the most favorable outcome we observed are for teenagers living with their biological parents who are married to each other. I wonder who's paying for these studies, incidentally. Maybe we were sort of become a faithless world. We've got to do a big study to find out what's as obvious as the nose on your face. One of my favorite quotes is when you hear a very bad idea, it's an idea that's so stupid that only an intellectual could believe it. And sometimes these ideas on restructuring family, taking an institution that has been with us from time immemorial, through cultures, through time, around this world, and changing it fundamentally because there's no difference between homosexual relationships and marriage, and we're meant to be ashamed to say, wait a minute, there's a little bit of difference here. The results are in. The difference is dramatic. There was also an Australian study done. I'm from Australia originally. And it compared the academic performance of children from three types of households. Children living with their married parents, children living with unmarried heterosexual parents, a couple, and children living with a homosexual couple. So children living with their married parents, children living with unmarried heterosexual couple, and children living with a homosexual couple. The study found that children from the married household outperformed the children from the unmarried heterosexual household, and the children from both forms of heterosexual households outperformed academically the children living in homosexual households. Now you might be asking, this is a lot of studies, how can I get my hands on this? Very easy. I published all this in Liberty Magazine in an article called Equality in Matrimony. Equality in Matrimony. If you just go onto the Liberty Magazine site, which is libertymagazine.org, you just put in their search part Standish, you'll find this article with all the footnotes for those of you who want to see the studies and for yourself. But it's not just that homosexual families or relationships, whatever you want to call it, couples, do not provide as ideal a situation for children to grow up in as parents do, married heterosexual parents, but it's also that homosexual behavior harms those who practice the behavior. According to the International Journal of Epidemiology, those who are involved in the gay lifestyle lose an estimated 8 to 20 years of lifespan. Homosexual behavior is associated with dramatically increased incidences of suicide. One study in the Archives of General Psychology found that men with same-sex partners were 6.5 times more likely to commit suicide than those who did not. That's a huge difference, friends. Is it the same or is it different? I would argue it's very, very different. It's also a dramatically increased incident of wide variety of sexually transmitted diseases. For example, those men who have sex with men have rates of syphilis up to 10 times higher than the rate of heterosexuals. Incidents of gonorrhea are estimated about 4 times higher. And there are many other diseases, of course, including HIV/AIDS rates. The Journal of Counseling and Clinical Psychology found that lesbians are over 2.5 times more likely to abuse alcohol than straight women, and also the rates of partner abuse are much higher, roughly 100% higher among homosexual couples than heterosexual couples. In contrast, and this is very important for you to understand, marriage, heterosexual marriage, if we have to put a qualifier in front of it, is better for children. We know that from the studies that I also mentioned, but it's also better for those who practice heterosexual marriage. Ohio State University did a comprehensive study, and what they found was that the mental and physical health of those who are married, heterosexual couples married, experienced significantly better physical and mental health than those involved in cohabitation and those who are single. In addition, married heterosexual couples live longer, which is good for me. I can take any advantage I can get. So people often ask, well, that's all fine and good. So heterosexual marriage is one thing, gay relationships are another. One is very beneficial for children, one is not. One is very beneficial for those who engage in it, one is not. But wouldn't it still be better to create, to change the definition at its base of marriage? Because at the end of the day, how does it harm heterosexuals? How does it harm anyone if we just expand the definition of marriage and let them marry? Well, the answer is, it harms in at least three ways. The first is, as a society, we would be going off a cliff, friends, because we would be taking a position that there is no difference between heterosexual marriage and homosexual relationships. And as we've just looked at a little bit this afternoon, there is a world of difference here. When society adopts a lie as a fundamental principle, that society is in big trouble. Are you with me? That's the first thing. But the second thing is that when we dilute the meaning of marriage, it has the impact of harming marriage across the board. How do we know this? Because there are countries that have already gone through this process. Take Sweden, for example. Today in Sweden, 56% of children are born outside of marriage. Should we care? Yes, we should, because cohabitating couples, Sweden has had a lot of attacks on marriage, just like we have, but they've maybe gone a little bit further, and they've also recognized a form of gay marriage over there. 56% of children, that's even more than we have now. We're about a third, they're over a half, born outside of marriage. We should care because cohabitating heterosexual couples break up at roughly 2 to 3 times the rate of married couples. So let me just make sure you understand this. When they adopted gay marriage, it didn't just expand the idea of marriage, it had a diluting effect on marriage in general, and now in the heterosexual community, 56% of kids are being born outside of marriage. Now you might say, well, I've been to Sweden and people seem to be not doing so bad. Friends, there is something that money can insulate you against. Not pain, but it can insulate you against some of the difficulties that go with parents and families breaking down. Norway, Sweden, Netherlands are all very wealthy societies that have a fairly equitable distribution of the wealth. Now, we can go back and forth on whether the way they do it is right and let everyone be convinced in their own mind, but that's the reality of it. Money can insulate you against some of the negative impacts of family breakdown. Certainly not all of them, not even close, but some of them. If we had that happen to us in America, the results on children, where we have a much greater disparity in wealth and wealth distribution, disparity on children, particularly children in lower income families, would be absolutely catastrophic. So it's not just that when you redefine marriage, it has just an impact on the gay community. It also impacts how marriage is viewed in society across the boards, and in the results are in it. In the countries that have adopted gay marriage, the number of heterosexual couples getting married has gone down. The number of children being born outside of wedlock have gone up. We can't afford to have that happen in America. We've already gone far enough down that road already with all the pain, all the suffering, and all the poverty and the child abuse that goes along with it. It also sends a corrosive message. You know, we just saw this report. Now, this is just brand new, but some of you saw this report out of Massachusetts. Now, Massachusetts has a particular role in this particular debate, that there are 17 schoolgirls who decided to get pregnant and raise their kids together. Well, for some of us, that's shocking. But for others, why not? We believe in any kind of marriage structure, whatever people want to enter into, don't we? As long as people have a plan and a way to do it, as long as the mothers love their kids, isn't that okay? Why be shocked? Massachusetts already said marriage is an anachronism. We can define these relationships any way we want. We can walk right away from it. It is no surprise to me, frankly, that this is happening. And I think the two things are connected. It's not only that this movement has a corrosive impact on how children and teenagers and then young adults and adults view marriage, but it also has a direct attack on religious freedom. And make no mistake about this. People say, who is this going to hurt? Well, we don't have to question that anymore, and I'll go down some examples. How could this possibly be an attack on religious freedom? Because the argument behind restructuring marriage is this, that sexual orientation is the same as racial identity, right? In other words, being gay is the same as being Caucasian, Hispanic, African-American, Native American, whatever it is, okay? Whatever your racial or ethnicity is. And that's a very clever argument, because what the gay rights community knows is that the minute that sexual orientation is equated with race, there are huge impacts on the religious community. And make no mistake about it, the gay rights community is aware that the biggest barrier to them succeeding is the religious community. Make no mistake about it. Now, I'll get a little bit more on that in a second. If sexual orientation is equated with race, as it has already been done in California now, we're just starting to see the beginning of this, then Christians are the equivalent of racists. If we stand by a biblical view of human sexuality. And indeed, I have sat across from the table from folks in the gay rights community saying exactly that to me. Over and over and over again in a negotiation. If homosexuality and race are essentially the same thing under the law, the first is those who keep to biblical sexual morality lose their right to use public facilities. Let me give you an example. The Sea Scouts in San Francisco. You know, there's the Boy Scouts and there's the Sea Scouts, right? Because the Sea Scouts refused to redefine their code to include homosexual counselors, the city of San Francisco, actually I think it was the city of Berkeley, which is associated there, took their right away from using a public dock for their boats. In Massachusetts, you also lose your right to participate in public programs. For example, in Massachusetts, Catholic Charities was banned from adopting children out, providing adoption services for what crime? Because they wouldn't adopt children to same-sex couples. Do you see how this starts off? I'm okay, you're okay. That was the original claim. Now it's, I'm okay, and you're a bigot, and you should be marginalized from society. This has huge impact for us, friends. I don't see the lights are on in your eyes. I know it's late in the afternoon. You've heard a lot of speeches. You're getting tired. Wake up. Because this is a battle that is going to be the parameter of where we are as a church for a number of years to come. Depending on how much time we have left. And Lord knows, only Lord knows. You also lose your ability to work for the state. Let me give an example. You know that California just redefined marriage. One of the first things that came was a Seventh-day Adventist who was working in the San Diego clerk's office. She wrote to me and said, I have been told that I either perform gay marriages or my future with this department are uncertain. I've requested an accommodation saying that it's against my religious faith to solemnize as marriage something that isn't marriage, that goes directly against what the Bible tells us is marriage. And the response that she got back was, we've had so many requests from people like you, we're not going to accommodate any of you. Now, in Massachusetts, the same thing happened. Now, for some of you, you're sitting back and you're thinking, how could that possibly happen? Well, I can tell you how it happens. Imagine, and this is the way the gay rights community looks at this issue and their sycophants, their allies, they think about it this following way. If you had someone working in a marriage office that refused to marry an Asian and a Hispanic, for example, or an Asian and a Caucasian, That would be racist. And we wouldn't want somebody like that working in the marriage office, would we? I think most of us would say, you know, that is inappropriate. It shouldn't be like being racist. In the, they say, well, race and sexual orientation, it's exactly the same. So if you want to be a bigot, you better get out of your job with the state. Do you understand what's at stake here? Are you with me now? If race and sexual orientation are the same thing, you, my friends, are bigots. You are the new racists. And that's a big problem, because the law has a way of dealing with racists. And most of us agree with it. I certainly do. I think it's great. But when that starts being applied to Christians for no crime other than holding on to biblical values, we have a huge problem. The final area, and there's many other areas, but this is just something for you to think about, is losing tax-exempt status. We've already had this happen in a case that involved a pavilion owned by the Methodist Church. They refused to have same-sex marriages in that pavilion on a beachside resort there in New Jersey. When they refused to, the state came back and said, that's against our public policy interests, because our public policy is that everyone is treated equally on the basis of sexual orientation. When you refuse to do that, we are going to take away your tax-exempt status. And they did. Now, for some of you, you might be thinking, can the state do that? Well, there's a precedent for this. But, of course, it's in the race context. Bob Jones University, some of you remember this. Bob Jones University used to have a policy that you couldn't have interracial dating on their campus. Well, the IRS said, you only get your tax-exempt status because you're fulfilling a public purpose. You know, you're fulfilling the goals of the state. That's why we give this to you. When you have a ban on interracial dating, you lose that. And once again, many of us will say, well, you know, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's a good thing. Certainly a ban on interracial dating is wrong. But once you say race and sexual orientation are the same, you see, that's when churches, hospitals, schools, everything, the tax-exempt status is up, and we are in trouble. They said it was just, I'm okay, you're okay, but it's not that. It's, I'm okay, and you, my friends, are bigots. And if you don't think that the gay rights community has their eyes on the Bob Jones case and what that means, once again, I was negotiating with them on a bill that we haven't been able to get passed because they're primarily the force that's blocking the bill's progress. And over again, they mentioned Bob Jones University. Bob Jones University, Bob Jones University, making that equation with what we stand for in the area of biblical morality with racism. And if they win, as they have in New Jersey, as they may win in California, depending what happens there with the ballot initiative, then they're going to succeed in marginalizing us in that way too. So this begs a question. We didn't get involved when marriage laws were rewritten. We didn't get involved very publicly on the issue of restating sexual morality in the area of fornication. Should we as a church get involved on this issue of redefining marriage? Should we make a stand? Well, there's lots of arguments not to. The first argument is we can't legalize morality. Have you heard that before? Friends, I got news for you. You can't help but legislate morality. Every law has a moral basis and a moral impact. I'll just give you a simple one. If you murder someone in the state of Pennsylvania, you have committed a crime. Because is that legislating morality? Sure. It's immoral to kill someone, isn't it? What people normally mean when they say that is you can't legislate sexual morality. But wait a minute. We legislate on sexual morality, don't we? What about rape? What about incest? What about age of consent laws? Those are all legislating on this. We do legislate. We must legislate in this area. So that's a completely fallacious argument that has to be left aside. Secondly, some people say, well, if we get involved on the marriage issue, it violates separation of church and state in some way that's antithetical to the Adventist experience. Friends, if we're going to stand up against Sunday laws, if we're going to stand up, as we did before, for temperance in the public square, if we're going to stand up on a variety of issues, there is nothing in the standing up for marriage that is antithetical to our experience and to our our history and to our basis for our stand. In fact, if there's one thing, if we can't stand up for children and the impact that these decisions have on kids, and for the religious liberty impact that these decisions have, we are, my friends, so tied up with an idea of church and state that we'll end up like the early church state leader, A.T. Jones, where Ellen White wrote to him and said, "The religious liberty work sickens me." So she wrote to him. Now, she wrote a lot of good things, too. But that was at one point where he was taking a very radical position. Religious liberty work sickens me. I hope that God doesn't look down on our religious liberty work today and say, ugh. Probably sometimes he does, but I pray not. And I pray that we have the courage to stand with the moderate and sensible stand when we're confronted by the issues that we face. The third argument is that this could lead to us being persecuted. If we can have a law that defines marriage appropriately, maybe that's going to lead to a Sunday law. Have you heard that? Sometimes people say that. And my response to that is, if we have a law against murder, that could lead to a Sunday law. There's no direct connection. We already have a law defining marriage. It didn't bring us out of Sunday law. Like, come on, people. Marriage is worth defending. It's one of the two things in the Garden of Eden. Surely we can have the backbone to stand up in the face of this and not be distracted by these tangential arguments. Some people don't want to get involved in this issue because they don't like the other people who are standing up against the redefinition of marriage. They say, look, it's the religious right. The religious right are, you know, straight out of prophecy. They're notice a suspect, and some of them are very unattractive characters. My response to that is very simple. We're our own people. We don't make our decisions because other people stand up for something or they don't. We make our decisions based on our understanding of the Bible and our history and our spirit of prophecy, and that's what we make our decisions on. And I don't care who's for it or against it. As long as it's right, I think we need to be there, irrespective. You know, Ellen White, during the Sunday law, first time around, they stood together with the liquor interests against Sunday laws. If our church can work together with the liquor interests, surely we can work together with other folks. Friends, there are many arguments against getting involved, but I'm going to tell you, the arguments for getting involved are much, much greater. Just a few weeks ago, I was sent a flyer about a meeting that's coming up at the Human Rights Campaign. Human Rights Campaign is the largest gay rights organization. They have a beautiful building downtown Washington, something like 150 people working there full time on getting their legislative agenda through. And that flyer said this: we're inviting people to come and hear a seminar about Adventists and how we want to get Seventh-day Adventists to reconsider their position on homosexuality. And we have people from Adventist Kinship coming. Have you ever heard of Adventist Kinship? It's an organization trying to get Adventists to redefine our position on sexual morality. And there's a whole description of what was going to take place there. This is not a fantasy. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is a tangible thing that's gone on there in Washington, D.C., examining each church to see if they can change our position, friends. And if we're not going to stand up here, make no mistake, our position is under attack. Just the other day, somebody sent me a link to the Spectrum blog. You know Spectrum magazine? It's like an Adventist magazine that comes out by... and that blog, that posting was all about how the Seventh-day Adventist Church has to redefine our position on marriage because homosexuality is not a sin. How homosexual behavior. Friends, we are at a turning point. We either stand now or we as an organization will be lost. We will compromise. Just like we have on marriage. Heterosexual marriage. You don't think we compromised on heterosexual marriage? Maybe we didn't compromise in word. We've done something much worse. We've compromised in practice. Haven't we? Of course we have. Either we're out there changing the world, friend, or the world is going to change us. There were two institutions God gave us in the Garden of Eden, the Sabbath and marriage. We must defend marriage with as much vigor as we would defend the Sabbath. Our children rely on us. Not just our children, but our children of our society. Our religious freedom is dependent on us taking a stand. And the souls, very importantly, the souls of those involved in this destructive lifestyle are at stake. Sex outside of marriage destroys lives. Adultery and divorce destroys lives. And homosexual behavior destroys life. I want to tell you a personal story as we close. It's a story about a family member of mine. He was very close to my age and we were very good friends. And when he got into his late teens, his early 20s, he went through a sexual identity confusion. He had a girlfriend, but then that didn't work out, and then he started got involved in homosexuality, and he went to an Adventist pastor in confidence, and he went to that pastor and said, you know, I've been involved in homosexual behavior. You know what, I feel very guilty about this. How can I reconcile this? And the pastor was a very loving, understanding man. He said, well, you know, I'll call him Joe. That wasn't his name, but just for privacy's sake. You know, Joe, we used to teach that homosexuality is sinful and indeed is like other sexual immorality. If you practice that, it's going to be a bar to going to heaven. Certainly, you know, there are some texts in the Bible that seem to indicate that, but we're now really into a new era where we have a much better understanding of sexual behavior. And we understand that this is a predication that comes at birth and that to control your sexual desires is very difficult. So we're really rethinking this, and don't feel like you have to change your behavior necessarily. And just know that there's, you know, grace and good things and so forth. And Peter left that, and Joe left that that meeting, and he had his, and he went about his life. I still remember the day that we got the call when Peter found out that he was HIV/AIDS positive. This is before there was the new drugs. And Peter was on the line, and he was crying. He said, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. He's a young man. He's a wonderful man. He's a beautiful man. Who was loving to him? Was it that pastor who said, go ahead, go about your lifestyle, there's no consequences, there's enough grace, and da, 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 da. Or was it those who said, there's sin, and there's standards, and God is calling you to a life of sexual purity? You know, I'm a lawyer. And when I hear that story, you know what it makes me think of? Malpractice. Spiritual malpractice. Telling someone that something's right when God tells us it's wrong. I know all of us want to be popular. All of us want to be liked. Nobody wants to be called a bigot. Nobody here wants to be out of step with society. We all are kind, nice people. Some of you are probably sitting here thinking, wow, this guy is really out of his nut getting up and speaking about this controversial issue and talking so openly. And we weren't born on this planet to be liked, friends. We were born on this planet to do right. Not to be insensitive, not to be unkind, not to be hateful. But there's nothing loving about calling sin good. Because sin, my friends, is evil. It will destroy us in this life. And Lord knows, it will destroy us in the life to come. We as a church have something to offer society. Silence in the face of evil is not an option, friends. It is time for each one of us, for us as a church corporately, but also each one of us as individuals, to make our stand and be counted, friends. And if you don't have the arguments, if you don't have the data, if you don't feel confident, you want to understand this a little bit more, go to Liberty Magazine, Google. Go and search Standish. You'll find an article, Equality and Matrimony. All of this stuff is laid out in a much more scholarly way with a lot of footnotes. And all the studies that you can reference yourself, friends. But at the end of the day, we are at a point where our society's house is on fire. And many of us are talking about how the house was built in generations ago, what needs to be done in the future. But we're living now, friends. And I pray that each one of you will stand up and be a witness for the issue that is now, not just truth, present truth. Let's just bow our heads. Dear Lord, thank you for the opportunity to come together and meet with brothers and sisters in your name. Lord, we face sophisticated arguments. We face a well-funded, well-manned opponent. But Lord, we know that your word is where wisdom is found and where truth is found. When you tell us not to engage in behavior, it is not just to keep us from something good, but rather to save us from harm. Lord, please help each one of us to be a witness, each one of us to be a light, each one of us to be strong and of good courage as we face this challenge. And Lord, please give us love, sensitivity, and care as we do that, because we know that in our society there are thousands of people hurting because of all the things that they've dealt with, whether it's their dysfunctional families, the decisions that they've made, the results of sin that all of us deal with in our lives and our characters. Lord, let us temper our strength with the love and compassion that only you can give us. We thank you for your promises to us. We thank you for your word of truth. In your name we pray. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.